closed captioned for the reality impaired. It's the Jerry Bader Show.
And good morning. It is 8:40. I'm Earl Brooker in once again for Jerry Bader on the Jerry Bader Show. And I commented yesterday, I came back from vacation and my key fob still worked. More importantly, after doing Jerry's show for a day, my key fob worked today. So that's a good sign right out of the blocks. But we have got a lot of things we're going to be covering. Just to mention a couple of them. President Obama, apparently now that he's done with his vacation, is going to go visit Louisiana after they've been flooded for 2 weeks. We're going to talk about more athletes, some that made up a story and are paying a dear price for it, and another athlete who didn't make up a story, did something horribly bad, but a judge decided, we can't ruin the poor kid's life. And those are things that we'll be covering as we work our way through the show this morning, along with some more presidential politics. Hillary, of course, was on Jimmy Kimmel Live making jokes about her emails and her health, and we'll have some of those cuts for you as well. But we're going to start off this morning with the 8th District Congressional Republican nominee, Mike Gallagher. He's with us this morning. Good morning, Mike.
Morning. It's good to be with you on this historic morning.
Yeah, it's a historic. And we'll get into why that is, but that's got kind of a nice ring to it, the 8th District Congressional Republican nominee.
Well, it was an honor to win the primary, and certainly, you know, you have this moment of realization where people just place their trust and their faith in you, and it's incumbent upon me and my team to get the job done, not only to win the election in the fall, in November, but to actually represent the 8th District with honor and integrity and fight as hard as humanly possible to get the country back on the right track.
And we're going to be talking about a number of the things that how you plan to do things when you get to Washington following a November election. But first, we have to give some people some background, and that is that your first time on this show was back in March of this year when you and I first met, actually. That was the first time we met. And then your second appearance came on June 6th, which happened to be my 35th wedding anniversary. You didn't know that at the time, but it was June 6th, and you started a movement at that point, the Free Earl Movement.
That's
and
right.
Now here's a brief portion of that segment with Jerry Bader from June 6th.
Well, you should. I mean, you met Earl Brooker on that occasion, for crying out loud. That is a memorable event. How could you not remember? You would think that date was like marked on your calendar.
It is forever etched into my memory. I have a complaint to make at the outset here.
Yeah.
So you have an asset here in Earl Brooker. This man has deep wisdom earned from pounding the pavement in the 8th Congressional District, local politics, knocking on doors. And I learned this the hard way when I went to go speak to the Lawrence Republicans, all three of them, including Earl's son, who was there. And I thought I was going to be speaking to these people, but it really ended up being the Earl Brooker show. This man held forth for about 30 minutes. He has wisdom that the world needs to see. Free Earl, Jerry. That's the movement I'm starting here. Hashtag Free Earl.
Hashtag Free Earl.
Now, that leaves us, when we get to this point, it leaves us, be careful what you wish for, because here we are, Mike.
Well, I gotta say, when I founded the Free Earl Movement, of which I'm very proud, I had envisioned maybe you doing a 10-minute segment every day. I didn't envision like a full-fledged military coup, and that Jerry wouldn't even be here to defend himself. So, listen, I'm glad that Free Earl has caught on like wildfire throughout the 8th District, but I think we may have gone a little bit overboard, Earl. Yeah, so I'm here to moderate your worst instincts today.
Okay, that's a good thing. I'm glad that you're going to keep me under control, because I'm sure Matthew will vouch for that I need all the controlling help that he can give me. But on a serious note, welcome, Mike.
I had to
share that with everybody this morning who might have missed it. You won the primary in August pretty easily, but can now the real work begins. Your opponent in November is Outagamie County Executive Tom Nelson. And as we go through some specific things with you, I wanted to have you point out where appropriate differences between you and Mr. Nelson. First of all, I'll start with the balanced budget. Why is that important and how will it get accomplished? The reason I bring that up is, A, they spend like money's no object in Washington.
Yeah.
Why is it important to have a balanced budget?
Well, you just look at the numbers. I mean, we are $19 trillion in debt, which is an accumulation of our deficits. I mean, that's such a big number. It's hard for us to even wrap our heads around it. But if you put it in more specific terms, a baby born today will inherit $58,000 worth of debt, to say nothing of the $155,000 in unfunded liability that it will inherit as well. I mean, this is a crime that we're passing this on to the next generation. Just look at just interest payments on the national debt. By 2021, we will be spending more money on interest payments than we will be spending on our national defense. That tells you how screwed up our priorities are. Yeah. I mean, that is wasted money right there. And a large portion of that goes abroad to countries like China. I mean, right there, we are where Greece was 25 years ago right now. And if we do nothing, if we continue down the current course, we will be Greece in 25 years. And incidentally, that's the best moral case you can make for fiscal conservatism. Because in times of collapse and fiscal austerity, who gets hurt? It's always the little guy that gets hurt. It's always the little guy. And who gets hurt by all these regulations that are just strangling small business? It's the little guy. It's the people that can't hire lobbyists and lawyers and special interest groups to do their bidding in Washington, D.C. We have a federal government that is completely out of control and out of touch with average citizens and we the people.
And I guess to go back on a couple of things, you know, you hear this term in politics all the time, and because I spent some time in government myself, you talked about unfunded liabilities.
Yeah.
Can you explain just, I mean, in layman's terms, what that means? Because it's basically debt that's built in that without even passing anything.
Yeah, it's basically promises we've made for which we have no money, right? Yeah. I mean, it's just, and it doesn't even get factored in to a lot of these numbers that get thrown around. I mean, we're on just an unsustainable trajectory right now. So forgive me if I get offended when career politicians like Thomas Nelson come to us and say, you know, I'm going to fix all your problems, or promise us really more of the same. That's right. Really what he and Nancy Pelosi and Hillary Clinton are promising us. It's nothing to see here. Look around. Hey, everything's going great. Let's continue down this course to becoming a debtor nation. Let's continue down this course of foreign policy weakness. And the two are related, Earl. I mean, you know, our economic strength is the foundation of our diplomatic power, of our military power. And so you erode one, you erode the other. And I think, as I've said on this show before, I mean, just look at what my hero General Jim Mad Dog Mattis testified before Congress the other year. I mean, no nation in history has maintained its military power if it failed to get its fiscal house in order. That's just common sense. That's what I was taught growing up working in my family's business. I mean, if you don't spend money if you don't have that money, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you don't spend more than you make. You prepare, because there are going to be rainy days. There's going to be downturns. I mean, that's any farmer who wakes up every day and puts in the work knows you got to prepare for the years when things are good and prepare for the years when things are bad. And we have a federal government that doesn't abide by basic Wisconsin common sense.
Well, and the fact is that the government has this tendency, well, things are good, let's spend some more money.
Sure.
And then there's, you know, it goes away.
Well, and look at, if I could add, I mean, just, you know, we all talk about waste, fraud, and abuse, and there's plenty of it. I mean, there's ridiculous. We spend $10 billion on tax subsidies to Hollywood and horse racing and wind, and, you know, Tesla gets tax breaks. But I'm a defense and national security guy, right? Mm-hmm. And I do believe we need to urgently rebuild the military. But the military doesn't get a free pass on waste, fraud, and abuse. I mean, I've seen that up close and personal, whether it's the $1 billion we spent bribing Afghan poppy farmers, and the next year they set the record for opium harvested, or the millions of dollars we spent importing rare blonde Italian goats to Afghanistan to stimulate the cashmere industry. The reason that is so pernicious in my mind is that it robs resources and training and equipment from the Lance Corporal, who's at the pointy end of the spear, who, you know, is from Northeast Wisconsin, who we are asking to risk his or her life on behalf of this country. We owe him our best, and at the very least, we owe him leaders in Congress and in the executive branch who understand the stakes for our national security right now and are willing to back him 100% if we're going to send people like that downrange.
Well, and I want to step back a little bit. You mentioned regulations a little while ago, too, and I'm a real live living example. I've been Jerry's producer for the last, you know, year and a half, 9 months. The fact is I worked for this company for 7 years prior to that. And Obamacare, which you hear people talk about, oh, well, there's nobody that lost their job or wasn't able to work because of Obamacare. I can tell you from a personal standpoint, even though it wasn't in effect, and I'm not And don't get me wrong, I'm not bashing the company I work for. I would be doing the same thing. But sure, people don't understand that regulations cause businesses to react to what those regulations are, which do cost jobs, which do cost money. The reason I bring up the Obamacare is after, I think it was March of, perhaps going back at least 2 and maybe 3 years, that our hour of limitations of work was 25 hours a week. Now, sure, the Obamacare threshold is 30. I can tell you that the summer before we went into that, I filled in on one of our sister stations. I worked 40 out of 45 sure days, and that went away. I could not work more than 25 hours a week for somewhere in the neighborhood of 2.5 years. But nobody was impacted that way by Obamacare.
Yeah, exactly. Well, the irony, Earl, of the day after you've been freed of the ultimate regulation here, you're complaining about regulation. No, I agree with you 100%. Listen, Obamacare, when Obama came to Green Bay, Wisconsin, Southwest High School, where my stepbrother went to high school, and gave his first Obamacare speech, really, this is where it all started. You know, he said, if you like your plan, you can keep it. And besides Benghazi, that would go down as the biggest lie of the last 7 years. And look at Obamacare is collapsing under its own weight right now. Average family premiums going from $13,000 to $17,000. Insurance companies pulling out of the system. And again, it is the irony of—
in mass, I might add, they're pulling
mass
out.
The co-ops, yeah, which you want a preview of single payer. I mean, look, we have an experiment. It's the co-ops. They're failing.
Yep.
I mean, at least half of them are done. But it is the irony of policies like this that centralize power and authority in Washington, D.C., that they always end up hurting the very people they're intended to help. And it's not just Obamacare. Look at Dodd-Frank. Mm-hmm. What has Dodd-Frank done, Earl? I mean, Dodd-Frank was supposed to punish the evil Wall Street bankers, many of whom do deserve to be reined in. Yep. But what did it do? It punished Main Street, small banks, community banks, and lenders. We're losing at least one of those a week, and not a single big bank has closed down. Because the people that can navigate regulatory complexity and ridiculous legislation are the people that can afford to hire an army of lawyers and lobbyists. And they're the ones that get richer at the expense of ordinary citizens and middle class folk and working class folk. And so the irony is almost unbearable. And I don't know if we talked about, you know, money in politics. I mean, mm-hmm, this is something people complain to me about. And as someone who had to, you know, I was a nobody, right? Yep. From the private sector, never run for office before. You have to raise a ton of money to even mm-hmm have any chance. But I tell people the best way to reduce the influence of money in politics, reduce the size of the federal government, because it feeds off itself. Every time you create a new agency, a new loophole, you create an interest group and a lobbying group that lobbies to keep it in existence, and a whole little industry grows up around it, and it becomes what we in the military would call a self-looking ice cream cone. It adds no value. It adds absolutely no value. So that's the
fight we
need
to have. I like that analogy.
Steal it. It's yours. Yeah. I stole it from somebody.
Yeah. You're a Marine, and from what I understand, there are no former Marines. National security has become a huge issue, and I think a lot of people used to not worry about it. When there was an election, it was always about my wallet. What's impacting my wallet? But now with ISIS and Al-Qaeda and things happening in the United States of America, national security has become a much bigger issue. Ways to deal with that, because again, and this has been stated a million times over, in the past when we've been at war, it's been against a country, a physical body. This is a group that exists but has no specific place that you can attack them. How do you deal with that, and how do you view your position on national security? Obviously, as a Marine, you have firsthand experience in that regard too. What would your plans be in regards to keeping us safe?
Great question. Essential question that every candidate running for office should be forced to answer. First, I would encourage everyone to understand how these are related, right? It's not, you can't make a clear separation between pocketbook issues and national security and defense, because if we do dumb things on the world stage that force us and drag us into unnecessary war and allow threats to increase such that we have to confront those threats later on less favorable terms, we will spend a lot of blood and treasure doing it. And that's why it's important for us to lead aggressively. It's important for us to be feared and respected on the world stage so our adversaries don't test us and drag us into unnecessary wars that we end up spending. What did we spend on Iraq and Afghanistan? At least $1.7 trillion.
It was a lot.
Dollars?
I mean,
we had to pay millions of dollars to hire special inspector generals to even understand where all the money went to. And we still don't know. So I just would encourage everyone to understand how the two are related. But in terms of how we get serious about the threat. And listen, 42% of Americans, I read an article yesterday, think we are less safe than we were after 9/11. I mean, that's the plurality of people. I mean, that's remarkable, given how much we spent, everything we've done. We don't feel like we're less safe, and that's because we're not. Mm-hmm. I mean, across the board, the system is blinking red. We had another terrorist attack in Turkey since last I came on the show last week. I mean, the global order led by U.S. power and the U.S. as the leader of the free world is crumbling before our very eyes. So the first thing is we need to demand that at the very least our political leaders stop lying to us. And I know we've talked about the Iran deal in this context, but across the board, I mean, the president just went out there again and said to suggest that the payment to Iran was ransom defies logic. Well, we learned that it was quid pro quo, right? Yep. They didn't let the money get delivered until they knew the hostages. I mean, our government is lying to us. They're removing any references to radical Islam from any transcript of a 911 call after Orlando. We can't even say the enemy's name. We can't even name it for what it is. And you mentioned previous wars, Earl. Well, yes, this is an unconventional enemy, but in the Cold War, we waged war against an ideology that was communism, as hateful and as dangerous as radical Islam is. Mm-hmm. And until we understand that and modernize our efforts in confronting this ideology, or at least admit that ideology and religion plays a component, we have no hope of being successful. The second thing we need to do is we need allies in the fight abroad. We need to take the fight to them abroad before it comes here at home, even more so than it already is. And we need to, unless we are prepared to do everything ourselves, we need to enlist allies, Sunni Arab allies in the Middle East in this cause. They don't trust us right now. They don't trust this president. They don't fear or respect us. Our enemies and our allies don't. I mean, our enemies feel like they can run over our red lines without consequence, and our allies can't make any commitments because they can't trust this president. We need to turn it around.
You mentioned this president. If everybody remembers back when he ran the first time, he was, you know, stressing the importance of, well, we need to sit down and talk to the bad guys, and then they'll, you know, respect us and they'll treat us nicer. That hasn't worked out so well, has it?
No, I interrogated a lot of bad guys. I was a counterintelligence, human intelligence guy, and my team did interrogations in Western Iraq. And you know, what I found bad guys respect more than anything else, it's power. And, you know, we succeeded in the surge because the good guys and the bad guys and the guys in the middle, a lot of whom we peeled off to our side, understood that we were the strong horse, that they better work with the United States of America. And we told them in return, we told the tribes, we said, work with us and we'll have your back. We'll protect you from people that not only want to destroy you, but also our way of life. And that worked, Earl. I got to tell you, I saw it firsthand. And the fact that we flushed all those hard-won gains down the drain. I mean, I've told you this before, but the town that I deployed to, Al-Qaim, on the Syrian border, where we were passing out books and soccer balls and school supplies when I left in 2008, is under ISIS control today. I mean, that's crazy. I mean, that's how far we've fallen under this president.
And the lives that have lost in the way of having that all happening is just unbelievable. I feel bad we're out of time here, but thank you so much for stopping by and chatting with us again. And, of course, the election coming up in November. Don't have, I think it's like 77 days now before the big day.
And 76, but who's
76,
counting?
But who's counting?
Everyone counts.
And we wish you well. Mike Gallagher, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Earl.
All righty, and of course, Earl Brooker in for Jerry Bader. We'll have more after the news here at WTAQ.